The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This is on Science for the People. We're talking about ideas of colonization and decolonization, trying to learn from our past, make real changes today, and speculating how we might avoid making the same mistakes in the far future. Welcome to Science for the People. I'm Michelle Fonda. With me is Ryan McMahon, an Anishinaabe comedian, writer, and actor based out of Treaty 1 territory, known today as Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Since 2010, he has recorded 3 national comedy specials, and his newest live show, Rec On Silly Nation, is scheduled to tour across Canada in 2017. He's the creator of the Indian and Cowboy Podcast Network and the host of 3 of its podcasts, Stories from the Land, Red Men Laughing, and Ryan McMahon Gets Angry. Ryan, welcome to Science for the People.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, you created and run a podcast network called Indian and Cowboy. First, can you tell us a little bit about Indian and Cowboy and tell us about a few of the podcasts that people will find there?
Sure. So, actually, today, on the day of this recording, Indian and Cowboy is 2 years old. So, it's our birthday party. We, being 2 years old, are still getting our pants and kind of confused generally about the world. But, yeah, we're the world's only Indigenous podcast media network. So we produce original podcasts, and we co-produce existing podcasts. So podcasts that were already being made out there in the world. We've 2 partnerships and agreements have agreed to be sort of like a placeholder for those podcasts just to amplify the work that is already happening. So on the network, you will find 10 podcasts in total, all made by Indigenous people from around the world. Now we have a new podcast coming. This is actually breaking news, so you got the scoop. yeah, there should be some bells and whistles. but yeah, we have an Indigenous podcast coming from Norway, from Sami territory. It will be coming to Indian and Cowboy at the end of 2016. And, yeah, so we are amplifying Indigenous, independent Indigenous voices. And, as you know, as a podcaster, all podcasts are niche anyway, but, we get super, super niche. So some of our shows are like Métis in Space is one of our leading shows on the network, but this is the niche. It's sci-fi from a decolonial lens. So if you enjoy sci-fi and decolonization, and red wine, by the way, because the 2 hosts drink wine and talk shop. If you enjoy those 3 things, then you'll probably enjoy the show. So we're just having a lot of fun being creative and being original, and finding our voices and making space where space didn't exist before.
You know our audience well, sir. Métis in Space was the first one I started listening to, so good choice.
Yeah, well, and, never mind that, Molly and Chelsea are, smart and funny, and really, when they told me about the show, admittedly, I just didn't get it. I was like, it's an audio medium, so you're going to watch a movie, then talk about a movie. And they're like, yeah. Okay, let's see how this goes. And, of course, we know how it's turned out. There's an ever-growing audience, for that show. And, I would like to, in the 3rd year, really try to get the network to a place where we are able to offer, live tapings of these shows. This 3rd year is all about development and growth. We have the foundation under us now. We've, purposely grown really slowly. And so as not to take on too much work, so as not to, overshoot the goals with the limited resources that we do have. But this 3rd year now is all about looking at new opportunities and finding a way to, grow these shows, but also, develop audiences and do some new things. So today on our second birthday, we're looking ahead already, and we love what we see.
There are definitely stories and conversations happening on the Indian and Cowboy podcast that I haven't heard anywhere else, and I listen to a lot of podcasts.
Yeah, I think that's the beautiful thing about the medium. You know, as you know, as a podcaster, it is empowering. It's creative work. It's fun work. It's rewarding work. It's I think it's important work. You know, it's to be able to access conversations or voices that maybe aren't a part of your community. That's a big part of life. You know, sometimes we get really lucky, and you have a chance. Conversation with a stranger at a subway stop, and it really makes you reflect and think, and you think, you know, damn it, I don't have enough of this in my life. Well, I think podcasts are a doorway, and you know, as we know, iTunes is full of these things, there's tens of thousands of them, and they're doorways, and you know, if you choose to walk through these doorways, a lot of the times you'll be surprised at what you find. We're trying to really, you know, create discourse and a voice for, you know, forward-thinking indigenous folks that really want to take, you know, take their ideas and put them forward as good pathways forward here in Canada and beyond. And you know, as I said, you know, so far so good. Some of our shows are, you know, runaway hits. Some of them haven't found an audience yet. As I said, we're working on little to no budget at all, and so it really does become about, you know, your publishing schedule and you know, keeping the ball in the air, if you will, you know, trying to keep the audience interested on social media, trying to make sure they remember you in a sea of other podcasts. So we're slowly getting to where we think we can go.
There do seem to be a growing number of podcasts that focus on issues of representation and identity, in particular surrounding issues of race. I'm thinking there's a particular white-black, particularly in the white-black race relations in the U.S. And while we do seem to be talking more about racism in North America, we definitely still aren't talking much at all about colonialism and the indigenous settler relationships here. The podcast and your network are some of the very few places where it talks about it explicitly, openly, and at length. Why do you think the subject is still largely ignored, even within social justice circles?
Oh, boy, you're trying to blow up my Twitter screen here now. I just think it's really hard to look in the mirror. I think that what did I tweet the other day? Whiteness is gonna white. So you know, it's just really hard to take a step back out of your own lived experience and really understand how intimately connected your life as a settler Canadian or as an immigrant to this country. It's really hard to understand how you benefited from this horrific past and the ongoing colonial structures that are alive and well today in Canada, you know, prop up these power structures. And so it's really hard to talk about because, you know, you're going, well, man, I love my summer home. What do you mean it's on stolen land? You know, does that make me a bad person? Well, yes, it does, unless you invite me there for 2 weeks out of the summer. But, you know, it's just a really hard conversation. And I think, you know, the timing is really important. And for our luck, we've managed to come at a time where we are starting to have these conversations. And we need to be gentle with each other. You know, we need to be patient. I can tell you, you know, one of the podcasts that I produce is Ryan McMahon Gets Angry. Well, that's kind of my non-gentle place. But in my real life, I really do try to make time and space for really understanding where we're at today in 2016 and being patient and understanding that we have a long way to go. And I choose to be, you know, proactive and try to create this space for everybody to I hear these voices, and, you know, I think that 30 or 40 years from now, they're going to look back at this time, and they're going to write books about it, and we all get to say that we were here, and we were a part of it, and that's, you know, to me, that's pretty exciting.
The two topics that come up regularly in episodes of Indian and Cowboy Podcasts are reconciliation and decolonization. And I had heard a little bit about reconciliation before finding your network, mostly from following the Truth and Reconciliation Commission work in Canada and the stories about residential schools. But decolonization was an idea I was mostly unfamiliar with. For people who are still unfamiliar with these terms, reconciliation and decolonization, what do these mean?
Well, reconciliation would mean, you know, to reconcile would be to make a relationship that was once good, good again. And so that's the problem with reconciliation today is I would argue relationships were never really good. I mean, you can go back to the fur trade and you could go back to first contact and there weren't ever really any good relationships. I mean, you know, this country, any country that is founded on capitalist morals, I think is on shaky ground. And the fact that we were founded by a corporation, the Hudson's Bay Company, as a country, should tell us that, you know, in business, somebody wins and somebody loses. And unfortunately, it was us, the indigenous people, that lost. And, you know, with reconciliation, it's about rebuilding relationships to make them good again. And I argue through the entire season, the entire last season of my podcast, Red Man Laughing, that reconciliation is completely impossible without the return of land. And so if we're talking about reconciliation and we're not talking about decolonization, which actually centers land and, you know, indigenous people's connections to the land, if we're not centering land in reconciliation, then we can't program and service our way out of, you know, child welfare crises that target indigenous youth. We can't program and service our way out of 1800 missing and murdered indigenous women. We can't program and service our way out of, you know, not having clean drinking water. Fundamentally, the structures are broken. And so, you know, we need control of our lives. And that begins with free, unencumbered access to our traditional territories. And unfortunately, when we look in our backyard, we see a big mess in our backyard. You know, we see towns, we see cities, we see universities, we see industries, we see pipelines, we see mines. Those are in our backyard. So it's a really complicated issue, and it's a complex issue, but really at its core, it's about reconciling that relationship between indigenous people and the last 150 years. And if we can start to really be honest about that, then I think we have a future. The discourse around reconciliation right now is frankly garbage. Because it's not centering land. And, you know, it's, politically, you know, the political will to do the right thing really has to be there. And that will come from the citizens, that will come from us. So that's why we've really put our voice in that direction. We really tried to be clear about, you know, we want to be on the front of this conversation about reconciliation because there is good work happening in regards to reconciliation. And we're trying to highlight that good work. In terms of decolonization, you know, it's the brilliant Eve Tuck, who's at the University of Toronto, she's a PhD there. She says decolonization is not a metaphor, so it's not some airy fairy artsy fartsy idea. Decolonization is about, you know, reconnecting indigenous peoples to their worldviews, their ways of life. You know, it centers land, so indigenous people's inherent connection to land, medicines, animals, plants, air, water. Decolonization, what I argue, is more important than reconciliation. In fact, I argue that, you know, all of these resources we're putting into this reconciliation industry that is being created should be redirected to decolonization efforts. And, you know, to decolonize a country, I don't know if that's entirely possible, but we can decolonize the mind. And colonization doesn't just affect indigenous people. You know, colonization is a poison that infects all of us. And so it is really looking at our relationship, both past, present, and future, in terms of this is the types of healthy relationships that we need to build in a fair and equitable and just society. So decolonization is, I mean, this may be a whole separate episode for you, but it is, yeah, it's a big conversation, and it's an important one.
So, even one more time, where are we failing? What kind of traps are we falling into?
Well, we're just being too nice. I mean, you know, it was interesting when I heard you use the word settler, and that's not a word people are comfortable with, right? For whatever reason, we don't want to use that word. But that's what happened. People came here, they never left. So they settled here. And then the argument, well, Canada is a country. Well, yeah, it's 150 years old. And it's, you know, until the Constitution was repatriated in 1982, it was a nation state. So really, like, this country that we call Canada is in its infancy. And, you know, I was at a building reconciliation conference with 350 of North America's leading scholars, university presidents, provosts, vice provosts, board members, so they can come and talk about reconciliation. And so things like mandatory course requirements and the relationship between university and First Nations and territorial local governments, like it was a very, very big conversation, you know, that had to be had at this conference. And I said, you know, one of the presidents got upset when I used the word settler on the mic. And I said, well, you know, like, really, this education around reconciliation begins with understanding settler colonialism. And you can't talk about settler colonialism if you can't use the word settler. So I think what we're getting wrong right now is we're afraid to unsettle ourselves. And what I mean by that is I need to unsettle myself too. You know, I need to decolonize my heart, my mind. I need to do the work that I need to do as an indigenous person to come with a good heart and a good mind to help contribute to this in a good way, right? I can't stay angry. I can't stay blaming the government. I can't have nightmares of Stephen Harper anymore. You know, I need to move forward in my life so I can live in a good way. Well, the settler population, Canadians generally need to be unsettled as well. They need to understand how uncomfortable true reconciliation will be because it is such a big project. So if you're not willing to be uncomfortable, if you're not willing to be unsettled, this is going to go nowhere fast. We also have to be honest. And I think that, you know, reading the 94 Calls to Action is a good start. Reading the executive summary of the TRC is a good start. But reconciliation is about your own personal connection to the Canada's past. We're throwing a 150th birthday party here in July, and I'm asking Canadians, what are you doing on July 1st? You know, to celebrate Canada's 150th? Because I can tell you, unequivocally, we're not celebrating Canada's 150th. We are going to take a really long, hard, critical look at what it means for Canada to be turning 150. They found, you know, tens of millions of dollars for their fireworks displays, but they can't find a couple million dollars to fund Indigenous languages. So there's real problems, and I think that's where it's at. We need to be really honest and be willing to do the hard work, you know, that is necessary. And the final thing I'll say, and I think it's really important to say, is this is not your fault. If you're listening to this and your bowl is clenched and you want to fight me and you've Googled my website and you tried to add me on Facebook and everything else and you hate me, it's not your fault, right? The thing that we have to understand here in Canada is that, yes, this information is new and we're learning about the horrors and everything else, you can't throw your arms up in the air and go, well, it wasn't me. Well, yeah, no, nobody's saying it was you. But Canada has benefited from these horrors. And so it is calling on all Canadians to speak out and to look in their own neighborhoods, their own families, to check their privileges, to look at their own biases. And, you know, it's a big project, but it's a worthy project. And for me, you know, looking, just using Canada's birthday as an example, the next 150 years, I hope, is a better one for, you know, my daughters, my potential future grandchildren, their grandchildren. I hope we can build a good society. We're doing the right thing. Doing the good thing becomes the mandate of Canadians. And we like to claim that we're good and that this is a utopia, but we certainly feel differently in many of our communities.
I know as I've been learning more about these topics over the last couple of years in particular, I've been reliably surprised and shocked by how much I don't know about my own country's history. And I think in Canada in particular, I just keep asking myself, like, why do I know more about the U.S. Civil War than I know about Canada's history? Why do I know more about Japanese internment than I do about residential schools? And trying to wrap my head around all of the stuff that was never taught to us, when that we just don't know, that's been erased, is a big challenge.
It sure is, and let's just look at that. Like, just what you said is a huge problem, right? I mean, we should certainly be demanding more out of our education systems, and we should certainly be looking at curriculums. And I know it's happening now because of the TRC, but my question is, had it not been, and we know, and maybe your listeners don't know, so I'll say it, the TRC, the 7 years that it existed, was paid for out of the pockets of residential school survivors. They were awarded a large civil suit in the Supreme Court against the government of Canada, and they put all of that money into creating the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, an unprecedented move. So it is residential school survivors themselves, literally, that gifted us with the TRC and its mandate and its work. When we think about the gift that residential school survivors gave us in giving the TRC its mandate, you know, we really have to look at our priorities, you know. And I think rightly so, in the 94 Calls to Action, those priorities are set out very plainly, very clearly, that education is a big part of what has to be fixed and what has to be changed. And like I just said at that Building Reconciliation Conference, universities, colleges, high schools, they are slammed with this right now. And it's a big, big, big challenge.
So are we making progress anywhere that you can see? Where are you starting to see hope and positive momentum?
Well, these conversations are happening, right? And I think that generally there is a lot of progress. And I could tell you, you know, 5 years ago, I would have never imagined a movement like we're seeing today grow, you know, that really focuses and honors, you know, residential school survivors' lives. You know, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people are really able to connect with the idea that we need to do the right thing. And so I think generally that concept, that idea is there. And that's, you know, surprising. I've come from a long line of residential school survivors, and it feels good to know that people are listening and have an awareness of what it is that we've gone through. It's just that we have to do the work. We can't skip steps. So I think there's good work happening, generally out here in Canada, but we can't skip steps. We can't say, the TRC has done its work, now it's time to move on. That's not, reconciliation is not recolonization, right? We are not going to be asked to come up to speed now, to pull up our bootstraps, to get with the program now that the TRC is done. In fact, it's the opposite. Now we really need to slow things down and work at other people's speed, because, you know, these residential school survivors have, sort of re-traumatized themselves, have told their stories, and they're out there for everybody. So now the healing work in our communities is really starting to begin, and we have to go slow. We can't skip steps. So I think as long as we're doing that, the positive momentum will continue to build.
So would you tell our listeners where they can find your network and all the wonderful podcasts on it?
Yeah, just go to IndianandCowboy.com. If you want to check out our shows, our full lineup is there. We're on Patreon.com. You can search out Indian and Cowboy there if you'd like to support us monthly. We are on all of the internets, all of the Facebooks and everything else. We have some exciting things coming in the fall. So, I'm excited. It's our birthday. I'm about to release our business plan to the world to show everybody what we've built over the 2 years and some of the ideas that we have. We're really trying to be transparent because I want people to see the potential in this and anybody with deep pockets to pay for it. Because let's face it, they have the land and I just have a little dinky piece of internet land. So any philanthropist, because there must be thousands of philanthropists that listen to your show.
I hope so.
Yeah. They're welcome to come and sit in. But on a serious note, we're working hard, and all of the shows, all of the information is at IndianandCowboy.com. I think starting with the website is a good thing. We are launching an app, but that is still, we're still just testing it, and it's probably 6 months away before we really start to roll out what that's going to look like. And that'll be complete with, writings and podcasts. And we're really trying to create something fun with our app to continue to find new ways to amplify Indigenous voices. But like I said, that's a slow and painful process. So you'll be able to find that sometime early in 2017. But failing that, we'll see everybody on the internet.
Ryan, thanks so much for sharing your time and ideas with us today. I hope Indian and Cowboy continues to grow.
I appreciate you taking the time, your interest, and I wish you the best of luck, too.
And if you want to learn more about Ryan McMahon, his podcast, or the Indian and Cowboy Network, we have links available for your clicking pleasure in the show notes for this episode, which you can find on our website, scienceforthepeople.ca. After the break, we have Desiree Stell moderating a panel from Skepticon at Convergence 2016 this past summer about how we can learn lessons from our colonial past and make better decisions in the future as we explore the stars and expand our reach.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show and podcast that explores everyday life from a scientific perspective. We are a member of the Skeptic Network, a collection of blogs, podcasts, and video content focusing on science and critical thinking. Find out what Science for the People is near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to support us at Patreon, to connect with us on Facebook and Twitter, and to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Hello, and welcome to Colonizing Colonization. Thanks very much for coming, everyone. I will be acting as your moderator today. I am Desiree Stell, host of Canadian radio show Science for the People. Thank you. And this presumably will end up on air, so don't say anything you don't want your family and friends to hear. How we're going to do this is we will start talking for a little while. We have some questions we want to get through, and then we will open it up after that to the audience. So when you do have questions, try and make it as brief as possible, because our poor panelists will have to paraphrase in a much shorter form whatever you said so that they can answer it, so for the benefit of our audience members that are listening on air. So I would like to introduce our panelists. Let's start right at the end. We have Cassandra Phoenix. She wrote her thesis on the effects of colonization on Maori literature in New Zealand and Aboriginal storytelling in Australia. She is fascinated at the ways that different cultures push against boundaries and where appreciation crosses the line into appropriation. She likes the possibilities inherent in liminal spaces. I love that.
How can I follow that up?
we'll get there. And then we have Emily Fink. Emily is a forensic anthropologist and science communicator. She is particularly interested in how culture, history, and biology come together to shape how we view the future. Her day job is as a QA analyst for a software startup, so she spends a lot of time dealing with the shortcomings of the tech culture that pushes so much of our dialogue about the future. And Celia Yost is a visual artist by training and profession with a very broad scope. At this point, her career has spanned everything from coloring books to decorative lamps, and she's also a landscape painter interested specifically in human-altered landscapes and the way that we impose ourselves on the land. Thanks for being here, everyone.
So, what we don't want to talk about today is basically to list a whole bunch of historical examples of how humans have been deeply awful to other humans, and then saying, so let's not do that in space. So, but what we do have to do is actually talk about where we think our problem areas are going to be, and what that reasoning is based on. So let's start with land and property rights. How have we screwed that up thoroughly?
How have we not screwed it up thoroughly?
I'm thinking of American colonization and the push towards the West and the sort of assumption that because other cultures that were we're not seen to own their own land because it just was not a function of ownership that the colonists understood. So that is a part of the way that we screwed up royally.
And what were the repercussions of that?
Well, the repercussions are that we have indigenous cultures who've lost a lot of their own history. And are marginalized to very, very small, very useless taxes that were ceded to them by the government, and lots of just bitterness and the loss of population and consequently just history.
This is going to be a super depressing panel.
Yeah, and I think going forward in space, we really need to be careful to make sure that we don't assume that just because we land someplace and don't see anyone we recognize as being alive or just at the moment, that free for the taking, because that, America's a good example, is a mistake that we have made many, many times.
Alright, labor exploitation. This is a really euphemistic way of saying slavery.
So, capitalism is great. Alright, so, an issue that we have with global trade is that, and this would be just expanded if you're interplanetary trade, is that you have a certain cost of labor. Just, you have to pay people, unless it's slavery. But that is actually the cost of goods, and you have different labor groups that have different costs of living and different expectations on what they get paid. But they're competing with each other. If a company has the ability to pay less to get their goods made, they probably will. So that has that discussion. And I mean, I work for a company that does overseas manufacturing. So.
And historically, when you combine the combination of exploration, corporate interests, and labor issues, you end up with really, really bad problems because the corporations are the ones funding it. So the corporations can say, we brought you to this new place. We now essentially own you. Even if it's not technically slavery, it's still a condition that can be pretty closely analog to it. And that's increases with increasing distances, so we would have a huge problem with, say, an asteroid mining field owned by Company X that now has these people that they brought out there, and they are far away from government oversight, they're far away from labor activists, and they would have a very good chance to exploit those people.
I don't have anything to add to any of that.
How about resource depletion?
Am I depressing you already?
Yes.
Personally, I would probably be one of the reasons why we would want to colonize space is for the resources. Like, I mean, I know in other panels, asteroid money has come up. I mean, on one hand, there's probably no one living out there right now. Maybe it's micro. But on the other hand, you end up with that situation where mining is a field that traditionally has some problems with safety issues.
Who's seen this? Who has watched The Expanse in here? The Expanse is an excellent example of how resource depletion doesn't necessarily have to mean complete resource depletion. We are taking everything, ruining it. It can be that you're taking resources and taking the resources back to where the money is. So taking the money back to Earth, back to whoever's funding it, and leaving the people who are actually in that area laboring to create those resources without many resources. I'm positive.
I have nothing to add to that. I'm more of a...
Oh, no, we're getting
you. Yeah. Basically, we all think that this will go really, really well.
Okay, how about environmental effects? We haven't talked about that yet.
Well, if you don't have to live there, you don't have to worry about the environmental effects as much because they don't affect you. So that's another issue with going to a place, taking the resources, and then leaving.
Also, I decided if you're not, like, native to your environment, you're an invading species, mm-hmm. and very bad for it, technically, usually. I'm trying. Yeah. Okay.
Also, we need to take a long view, particularly when entering new environments. Even if they aren't already inhabited by people, we can create huge problems for our future when we basically left something in nuclear wasteland where we've taken resource A through massively destructive technology. So it's not just environmental depletion now, it's environmental depletion for the next 500 to 1,000 years.
And that leads directly to the health effects that we seem to have on every other culture we ever come into contact with.
Horrible.
We make a habit of introducing new and exciting diseases to the population.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I'm thinking of those smallpox blankets.
Everyone's thinking of smallpox.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about the cultural areas, because I think this is where we're going to get into some neat stuff. What might we expect to do to other cultures based on what we've already done to other cultures?
Stampede over them and put our flag where theirs was. If they have a flag, if they don't have a flag, they have no country.
So we are really bad at acknowledging other forms of culture, too. So while a group of people have a complete functional society in their own way, Europeans are really bad at saying, oh, it doesn't look like ours, so it must not be a thing. Here, have a flag. Now you're better off. You have Christianity and a flag. Yay!
And tea.
Tea is important.
Yeah, I mean, even in more forms that look more benevolent, like, oh, we will help you, we will bring Christianity to you, and this will make you better and more civilized. That doesn't necessarily, well, it probably is not actually going to end well.
Well, they were already civilized to begin with.
Yeah,
they were recognized as being civilized.
So, Cassandra, can you speak a little bit to what sort of the longer-term consequences of that are? Because I know you studied literature, mm-hmm. Literary literature. So what kinds of things can that have in not an immediate way?
Well, in Lamar, is a very special case because they were one of the cultures that, like, really fought hard and were sophisticated enough to try to write treaties and that sort of thing. And they only found out later that they'd gotten totally hoodwinked and gotten a different language, treaties and signed away things that they had not intended to. But the long-term effects of that sort of thing in a culture is that they were trying to wrest their own stories back from the colonization of the stories that they were trying to tell. And with the Aborigines, their culture was much more oral culture, and so learning to write that down sort of, I mean, it's the sort of the question of the gaze essentially changing what it's looking at. So, like, you have a culture that is oral storytelling, and then you have to learn the language of the colonizer to write your own stories, and so therefore you're not writing your own story, really. So that is, like, one of the long-term effects.
All right, so I think it's obvious what the impacts are on an oppressed culture. But how about on the oppressor? Are there actual downfalls because of the colonization process to the group of people that are actually doing the oppressing?
Well, once you started out with a hierarchical culture where you've already said this particular group is not worthy of respect, of rights, of their own resources, it's very easy to ride that into other groups. So you look at the groups that are historically oppressing, they're also historically oppressing people in their own groups. And I'm not sure if we can think of any groups in our culture that are oppressed, even as nominally part of white Western American culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, it's a very complicated thing because, basically, Europe, most of today's world is Europe's fault. But, I mean, if you go back to the individual countries, like within those countries, there were a lot of internal problems. There was a lot of class problems. And part, I don't have a coherent point. Never mind.
No, that was all pretty succinct. I'm good.
You guys are probably sad.
I'm sorry. Okay.
Was this meant to be like an
episode? Yeah, no. There's no way to make this up. But I guess, so, in order that we don't have the conversation about, okay, all those things are bad, let's not do that in space, could it actually be worse? Like, could it? Right, because that's my concern, because we are, at least when we did this on Earth, there were groups around to see the problems inherent in those kind of conditions and to call it out. We had people that could actively protest that were part of other cultures. But we might not even have that because these planets are so far away.
Well, also, and it's bad enough when you're recognizably, at least physically, human to another human being. You know, what if you're not recognizing that there's a sapient being in front of you because it doesn't look like what you're used to thinking of a sapient being, even an inferior sapient being?
There's going to be even less potential empathy.
And also just less chance of finding common ground on which to meet. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, everyone will be just sort of automatically inferior.
Yeah, I mean, like, what if we find aliens that look like rocks? That look like rocks that we want to mine. And it takes 100 years to figure out that they're actually sentient.
What did they do in that Star Trek episode? Does anybody know?
It was
we don't have that rock.
That is our problem.
It's a big problem.
Okay, so
being all this being as it is there any kind of practices or policies that we can start to put in place now so that when we do get to that point, when we are thinking about colonizing other planets, let's say, that we are bound to maybe not do the things that they're doing right now? Or is it a certain mindset that we should be starting to get into that we weren't in before as a people?
I think that it would be very helpful and probably impossible to just institute the assumption that you're the superior race going into whatever situation it is. You know, just leave yourself open-minded to the possibilities, and that is not something that's historically ever, I think, happened. If we were going to change something, that would be the thing that would be the most important to change, would be that, like, you may be the apex predator on your planet, but you're not Jack on the other planet.
We need to have both cultural and codified law changes, and I think a lot of what the more social justice-oriented people who are working on Earth to fix racism, sexism, classism, ableism, that's going to have a huge impact on how we would potentially interact with another group. Because we're really not good at that with humans. Like, we're really not good at that. But we need to be good at that for ourselves, and that would also have the additional help of, well, maybe we won't mistreat those rock creatures.
Yeah,
Yeah, we need to actively try to not screw over other life forms, which, again, historically we've done a very bad job of. What actually makes me worry is, like, yes, you can codify these things in the law, but what happens when you have a corporation going out and exploring, and they get into trouble, and like, oh, government, come help me.
I have lots of thoughts on corporate exploration. Both good and bad. Corporate exploration is absolutely necessary in the way our financing is set up right now, and it is a huge possibility for a force for evil in our world. When you have a corporation that has both lobbying power and is far away from other people to institute effective oversight, you get huge, huge problems, even with the best of intentions. You'll get, like, just look at what mining companies do now. And mining companies are not far away. They're in the middle of Kentucky. That's 2 hours from where I live. And it's really hard to have good government oversight and human rights practices in companies like that. So, yeah, we're going to have to put a lot of oversight. There's going to have to be active labor activists. So we'll have to be people in any future colonies who are going, you can't do that. I'm going to tell everyone now.
Are we really saying that there's literally no way to just make humans be nice? Like, is that what we've decided as a room? It's just like, this is going to happen, and we are awful.
You can't legislate niceness.
Yeah. Oh, that is tragic, you guys. All right, do we want to take some questions now?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the question was, if we have technology that could benefit another culture and they don't, is it then our right, or should we then use our technology to help them? I just think we still need to ask permission and try and explain exactly, give them all the context and all of exactly what we would do and let them decide. I mean, because they may have some reason to not do this, even if we think it would help them. And even if we think that the reason that they're not doing it is going to eventually cause their extinction, it's not our job to, you know, if they say no, and they have all the information at their disposal, then, yeah, and gotta respect the culture's decision.
Consent still counts.
Oh, yeah. No means no.
So the question is, what if governments on other planets are also insane or uncaring and incompetent? Or exploit us. Thoughts?
Okay, so...
Did you say... Oh, yeah, that was close.
Alright. Well, how are we going to determine that? And you would still somehow need to talk with the individuals you're worried about being exploited and get their consent. Because, again, we've invaded countries because of human rights violations, and human rights violations have only gotten worse. So that is one of the big mistakes I think we need to not repeat in space.
The question is how if it's humans who aren't actually trying to exploit for wealth or resources, they just want to go live somewhere else, expand the human species. How do we do that in a not damaging way, in a way that wouldn't damage the ecosystem of the planet we're going to? And we probably really don't. Invasive species are really good at being invasive and really bad at not damaging things, whether it's locusts or humans.
Well, I mean, this is a problem across every species.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't imagine that it would be any different for humans.
Hmm. Heck, look at Tug do.
It's totally good.
There's one back there?
Yeah. Okay, so
I'm super excited about Space Union.
The question was, is how do we keep corporate money from taking over space travel and, yeah, Space Union? Or, again, strong government oversight.
Is there literally any other way? I'm interested in hearing from the audience. Are you guys more creative than we are? Because obviously we think we're all screwed regardless.
Mm-hmm.
Like we have to rise up before we get up there in order to protect other species. That's all I'm seeing here.
I would totally vote for that.
Our Earth is not united, so what happens when the U.S. and China and Russia and Europe all are trying to colonize space at the same time, and they all want to be the first ones to do it? That, again, is one of the reasons why colonization got screwed up on this planet, is all the European countries are competing with each other for the resources and land.
So I think the idea of a model UN for these kind of issues makes a lot of sense. But I don't know if anyone's noticed how the current UN is working.
Oh, yeah, that's what I was considering.
If we're actually advocating for revolution in this room, I'm super in.
I would like to note we are all on a communist watch list now, so.
Yes, I always was. Yeah. Sorry. Right at the back.
The question was a comment from the audience that, speaking of corporate exploration versus government exploration, that a lot of the research and technical innovation is coming from the government and not from the corporation, and that just, it's not true now, and it's not true in the history of exploration. Governments tend to work through non-government contractors, so you get the British government working through their companies. You get the Dutch East India Company, you get the Spain and Portugal sending out subsidiary bankers and investors. You're not working directly through the government. You're generally working through some sort of corporate infrastructure, which I'm not advocating for. I don't enjoy it, but I also, our government's really bad at funding basic research without an entire government shutdown. Look at the Orion Project at NASA right now.
Can I just paraphrase, we're awful to each other? So why wouldn't we be awful to another species? And I think that's the question, right? And we have this conversation. I think this is my third panel that we've talked about this exact same issue. We cannot be trusted. So, at this point, you know, the idea that should we be traveling anywhere? Because I think we're worse for other species as more so than them being bad for us.
Well, I'm reminded when I don't read a lot of hard sci-fi, mainly because I'm not scientific, but when I read The Three-Body Problem, and the most interesting part of that to me was that what if instead of, you know, the United States getting contacted by an interstellar intelligence, it was Cultural Revolution China? And how badly sideways could that go wrong for everybody? Because that Cultural Revolution China had a totally different agenda. And so that's the part of the problem is, like, you know, everyone has an agenda. And so we have a different agenda. Everyone has a different agenda. So this agenda is the primary agenda. So, yeah, I mean, what would we say? Who is going to be the one who gets to have the most important agenda?
Another question was, what would be, saying we went to a planet that was entirely empty, what would be the effects of creating a new civilization from scratch in a vacuum? Literally, in space.
And go. It would really depend on who was creating it, you know. There are many books about that kind of thing, and many different people. I mean, you could have, like, the Vatican City with money sending, you know, its people up to create a society. And what kind of society would that look like? Well, is that a society that I would want to live in? No. So I guess that would really depend on who you're sending up there. I mean, that makes all the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, everyone's bringing their agenda.
you know, that goes along with all the, you know, baggage and luggage.
That is one of the things that we were discussing in the panel previous today, is who exactly are we sending on these colonization projects? Are we sending our best and brightest, or are we sending, for all intents and purposes, disposable people because we're probably going to screw it up good the first time?
And how do we create that, which is what we were talking about in the It Takes the Village 80% suitable. Like, how are we going to curate that group of people that we send? You know, who gets to decide? And, you know, that brings it back to eugenics and other horrible things. And so, yeah, I mean, it's...
Well, it didn't work.
Yeah,
and who says our best and brightest aren't the disposable ones? If they're the charismatic people who can get the story out, okay, go die on Mars.
Whoa.
Yes. Okay. Right there.
So, to paraphrase the question is, what do we need to put in place to make sure that we don't create a cataclysmic, unintentional altering of a system?
I don't actually think that's possible, because you'd have to land on the planet first to decide what it was that you would have to protect against, and therefore you're already introducing the alien aspects to the environment. So you'd have to not land at all, ever.
Well, we already take those measures. They're imperfect, and they're only to the extent of what we can actually do, but that's always going to be a limitation. We are going to change the system just by being there. That's what we're going to do, and all we can do to prevent that is basically what we're doing already, which is keep it as sanitary as possible, keep it as spread out as possible. Things are going to get through. That's what happens.
We're dealing with about 17 levels of what if, and we're never going to be able to account for all of them, but we can, at very least, as we do our best, and we have the kinds of conversations that are happening in this room right now, and I desperately hope that people in positions of authority are having them, because we don't mean it.
NASA has a person in charge of planetary defense for exactly that. Not to defend our planet, but to defend the rest of us from us.
Okay, one last question. Right back.
So the comment was, life is prolific and is competitive and will destroy something just by existing. Well, I mean, the thing is, the stuff we have this capacity to have this conversation, I think we need to try to negate the negative effects as much as possible.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so what did we decide today?
That we're awful and we should stay here?
When I showed up at this conference, I was pretty sure that I wanted us to go to space, and now I'm pretty sure I don't think that's a good idea.
I want us to go to space. I just want us to continue talking about it.
Yes, that's it.
I'm on John McCartney. All right, thank you for everyone who came today.
Thank you.
That was a recording from the Skepticon track at Convergence 2016, which took place in Bloomington, Minnesota. Thanks to all our wonderful panelists, everyone who showed up to watch it live, and to the organizers of both Skepticon and Convergence who made it all happen. Also, a very special thanks to Kevin Eldridge and the Flopcast, who helped us record panels at Convergence when our equipment failed. You're our hero, Kevin. Seriously. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.
Science for the People is produced by Rochelle Saunders and edited by Ryan Bromsgrove. Helen Quiblon is our publishing liaison. You get research help from Josh Whitten. Coordination and additional behind-the-scenes support comes from the Enthusiastic Skeptic Network team. Our theme song is written and recorded by Fractal Pattern, and its title is Binary Consequence. Science for the People is listener-supported.
You can find us on Patreon, where you can support us with monthly donations in any amount. In return, we regularly post special patron-only extra content and after-show casual conversations with guests. This show is created in partnership with the Skeptic Network, a collection of blogs, podcasts, and video content focusing on the intersection of science, popular culture, politics, and social justice. You can find out more about Skeptic at skeptic.org. The show is hosted by Rochelle Saunders and me, Deborah Sell.